Thanks for joining us this week for the Whitetail Watch podcast presented by Realtree. We're going to have an awesome episode for you. I've got Greg Clements up in the studio with me today. He's one of our co-workers here at Midwest Whitetail. How's it going, Greg?
Great. Yeah, excited to be talking to Bryce Lambly today. A Nebraska native, born in my hometown, lives just right down the road from my hometown, and a very accomplished bow hunter, as we're going to see.
Yeah, I just got done reading one of his books. What was that called? My Neck of the Woods?
My Neck of the Woods, yep.
Man, that was, I read 10 or 12 chapters out of there just the last couple of nights, actually. You were telling me about him earlier this week, and this guy is very accomplished traditional archery hunter. He's killed over 100 big game animals, I think, with his longbow, hasn't he?
Yeah, with a recurve longbow. He's been bow hunting for 30 plus years and has hunted whitetails in the Midwest as his bread and butter, but hunted all over the U.S., the Midwest, Africa.
Yeah, he's got a long list of cool experiences, so it would be nice if we can get Bryce back on here again for some future podcasts. But on the show today, we're going to ask him about early season whitetail hunting. Nebraska's archery season comes in pretty early, and Bryce is well known for having success on mature bucks during that time frame. We're going to touch on that. He also kills a lot of these bucks using creative, out-of-the-box type tactics.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've always appreciated about Bryce. He uses a number of different tactics, whether it's off the ground, stalking through a cornfield, hunting out of small trees that you would never think that you could kill a whitetail out of. He's a wealth of information, and has just had a lot of different experiences, and he's a very adaptable bow hunter.
Right. He killed one of those deer. He was climbing up an irrigation pivot, I think, and he actually spotted the buck and ended up stalking him through a cornfield. Some pretty cool stuff. So we're going to try to grill him on a variety of topics today. So let's give Bryce a call.
Hello?
Hey, Bryce, how's it going? This is Aaron Warburton and Greg Clements.
Hey, how are you? Very good.
Good deal. Are you still good to go for the next little bit here?
I just told my daughter to leave me alone for a little while. Yeah.
Cool.
She came down, wanted me to go take her, get her nails done. I said, that's going to have to wait. So anyway, yeah, I'm good to go.
Bryce, we've just got done sort of introducing our viewers to your resume, which is a pretty lengthy and successful one. Greg introduced me to one of your books just a few days ago, and we've been reading some of your stories, and there's a million questions we could ask you, but we'll try to keep this podcast more focused on early season whitetail hunting and some of your creative tactics that you've used through the years. But you seem like one of the most adaptable bow hunters that I've ever seen. To kill a buck, you've done it numerous ways. I mean, we were talking about a while ago, Greg, you shot one buck out of a tiny little cottonwood tree.
Yep, from the ground, tiny yep. little trees, stalking through a cornfield. That's what I've always appreciated about Bryce's hunting style, is that it's very adaptable.
With that being said, Bryce, what do you think is the number one factor that plays into your success?
You know, it might be my background as a teacher, where, you know, you would assume that most teachers would be, you know, feel like it's been very important to learn. And I think this idea of a lifelong learner has to apply to bow hunting, too. I don't ever want to get so set in my ways that I don't adapt to what's changing around me, or I don't overlook something that could help me. And so I like to think that each time I go to the woods, I'm trying to learn something.
Yeah, and that's very good advice. It's definitely worked to this point.
And maybe one thing we haven't mentioned yet is how many days that Bryce actually spends in the field every season.
Well, I do spend a lot of time, frankly, I'm going to get to spend a lot more time now that I just reached early retirement from teaching this last May. And so I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, most years I probably get in anywhere between 80 and 100 hunts, occasionally more than that, and once in a rare while, less than that if I would happen to tag out both tags in Nebraska early. But it's usually about a 90-day season for me.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of time spent in the woods. And if you've got that attitude where you're out there and your primary goal is learning, you know, you've got a long list of a good background for tons of education, and I want to dive into that a little bit with the properties that you hunt. How many areas do you typically hunt in a given year, and is most of your hunting taking place in Nebraska there where you're from?
Almost all of it's in Nebraska. Now that I've got teaching out of the way, and I already did apply for another preference point in Iowa, so I may start going back to Iowa some. And I've got some connections in a couple other states that I'll look at now too. But I've always wanted to devote most of my time in Nebraska and to my family, where I can do both of those at the same time. In Nebraska, I basically hunt four different properties, all fairly close to each other as the crow flies. The two are on the south side of the Platte River, and two are on the north side of the Platte River. And kind of over in the North Bend area, generally speaking, I grew up in North Bend, and so my family still has connections and with some folks over that way, and people that knew me growing up and that type of thing. But as time's gone on, I've been bow hunting since 1981 for big game, and my landowners are getting older. I'm getting older, and some things have changed on those properties, and so I'm going to have to become even more adaptive, I think, in the future as development kind of eats up on some of those properties. Properties along the Platte River, they're flat, they're private ground, they're agricultural based mostly, varying amounts of timber, and zero food plots. I mean, there's cornfields and bean fields and that type of thing, but I have never, ever been able to hunt a situation where I've been able to tailor the ground a little bit more to my liking, so to speak. I do have some ideas on how that might be done, but most of my hunting is reactive. I see what the farmer's planting this year and what the mast crop is doing a little bit this year, and then I go from there.
Do you have a feel for what average deer density is on the properties you hunt, and maybe age structure?
I do and I don't. If you'd asked me that 15 years ago, I might have been able to throw some numbers at you. The deer numbers have really fluctuated a lot. We had the big EHD kill mm-hmm. a number of years ago. I can't remember how long ago that's been now, but we had that big EHD kill. And then they bounced back pretty decent. You're starting to get back to normal last year. And then we actually had a little bit more EHD that was not talked about very much in that area of Southern Dodge and Northern Saunders County over by like Camp Moses, Merrill. It smelled like death over there again.
Wow.
And so we're still not back to the high deer density days of like maybe 2000, and we're still not back to the higher level of age quality that I probably saw up until about 2010-ish. But I can't complain. I've still got deer to hunt, and every year I'm usually able to find one or two that I'm really interested in, and once in a while I get to tag one of those too.
Sure.
But the numbers are down a little bit, I still think.
And do you share these properties with other people?
Yeah, that's the other thing. I none of these properties are exclusive for me. And
wow.
One property, I've got to call the landowner every time to even step on the property. Another property, I don't have a lot of competition there because there's hardly any trees on that property, but there are some bird hunters there as well. And then my two main properties, I've got substantial competition on the one property. And the other property that's been kind of my go-to ground, it was just logged out this last fall, and there's not much left. I'll bet you they probably took 95% of the trees or more. And I'm not excited about that, but again, I'm going to go back in and look at things and see, if something can still be done with that property. The property next door in that case is a much better property, and even more so now with the logging that just took place. But early in the season, I still think there's going to be a window of opportunity to kill something nice if I can locate them and get onto whatever new movement patterns are going to be on that property. They literally took almost every single tree off the property now.
So it sounds... Oh,
sorry, Greg, go ahead.
It sounds like you deal with the same thing that a lot of people do. I know I've experienced some of that in eastern Nebraska or around Blair there, development taking up hunting land and reducing hunting opportunities and access. So that's a real challenge.
Yeah, it does. And I think, again, part of your strategy ends up being, are there going to be guys out there this weekend? Maybe I need to go during the week. And is there, are there other guys hunting, and where are they hunting? And so maybe I need to go to a spot where the deer might be pushed into that corner of the property. Also, I think a lot of times when I'm hunting a property that I think is really the second or third best property in that specific stretch of river bottom, I really hunt the edges of my property because I want there to be an illusion that my property is not being hunted. I try to foster that illusion as best I can and leave some spots of those properties relatively untouched. So hopefully deer will become a little more comfortable on the lesser of the property, at least as I perceive it to be. But it's a chess match, and it's not just the deer, it's other hunters and farm operations, and then like last year, the logging operations.
Yeah, it's very similar to what we go through on public land every year. Myself and Greg both hunted public land last year almost exclusively. Occasionally, Greg hunts a few other small properties, but it's very similar. Even the private small properties that we're hunting, very similar in the fact that there's other people that have access, and the public lands that we're hunting mm-hmm. obviously have access too. And that's a great tip that you just mentioned that we don't talk enough about. And Dan Infault was actually telling me about that, how he goes about hunting big public properties in Wisconsin is he bounces around the edges. And, he gets scent in those areas on purpose. He goes in there and hunts those bedding areas on purpose to sort of concentrate the deer in more favorable locations for him as the season progresses on. But with early season bow hunting, how are you going about finding the bucks that you want to hunt?
Well, I've been a fan of the trail camera since about 2000, maybe 1999, somewhere in there. And actually knew the fellow that started Cam Tracker and got to know him really well. And what I found was that the it seems like there's a place or two or three on every property where you can get a good inventory of all the bucks, and it varies. And the development has really messed up a couple of my spots over there by North Bend, but I still seem to be able to find that spot where I can locate a camera to catch at least most of the bucks at one time or another in July and August, especially August, and get them on camera so I can start getting an inventory and seeing if there's something there that I really want to pursue. A lot of times those places will be a lane a half mile from the timber, oftentimes a lane between two cornfields. Just setting your camera up on a post there, and I think the deer will walk those lanes at night. Part of it maybe to keep from bumping their antlers, I don't know, on corn stalks or tree limbs or whatever. I don't know if that bothers them. Some of it I think it's a little bit like, they can be showy and with each other, because a lot of times the pictures will be two or three or four bucks walking down the lane at the same time. And so I think it's maybe has something to do with parading around a little bit. And also, I mean, the perfect situation, it seems like to me, is if I can find a place where there's a lane between woods and corn, or between corn and corn, and that lane leads to a bean field that's located away from the timber. And so rather than spend time glassing over that bean field, that by the time the season starts, it's probably going to be starting to turn brown and the deer are going to turn off. I use that bean field as a magnet for my trail camera operation to pick up the deer going through there. Another place that I seem to have pretty good luck with finding deer in the early, in the late summer, midsummer, I should say, is a lane that's, again, it's a half mile from the nearest timber. It's actually very near Highway 30, but it's a place where I think deer just are out for lollygagging, looking around. And it's a lane that's far out away from anything that remotely resembles something you'd think about putting a tree stand in. But there's a couple of licking branches and old scrapes, and they'll even visit those. They'll even scrape in August and September. Well, of course September, but even in August, I'll see them visiting these licking branches and these scrapes. And so I've got a stand or a camera located over that usually gives me a really good inventory of deer that I will be a half mile away when I'm hunting them in late September and October and November.
I'm assuming you're finding these bucks then on these properties that you've already scouted and hunted for several years. So if, for example, I'm guessing here, but if you get pictures of a specific buck coming out of there that you want to shoot, you already know kind of where he's living at on that property or where you're going to be hunting him because you've scouted and spent time there in the past.
I do think longevity on a property really helps. And I've got some go-to spots that have, you know, when in doubt, I can go back to these go-to spots, and usually I can get a handle pretty quickly on what the deer movement is. The property that has been kind of my laboratory for the last 20 years or thereabouts is the one that just got logged out, so things are really changing, and I'm kind of just about ready to start digging into that project and seeing what that's all going to be all about this year. But yeah, and a lot of times though, that I guess on this specific property, the bucks are often bedding on a neighbor's property, and it's just a jungle of cedars and cottonwoods, and it's hard to even walk through at times. And it's those deer. Again, I really feel like it's important for me to make them feel like they're not being hunted, not being monitored. And so most of my summertime scouting and trail camera activity is on the lane that the farmer uses. And if I can, you know, I want to replicate or mimic the farmer's actions. And so I don't want those deer to think anything's up. And of course, that's paramount to all of us, what we're trying to do. But I end up killing a lot of these bucks on that property, actually either in the corn or very near the corn, and never even entering the woods yet, because sometimes I think in the summertime too, the deer prefer the corn to the timber for the lack of mosquitoes. There's mosquitoes in the corn, but I also think that the bugs are worse in the timber. And so I can sometimes feel like the deer are spending a lot more time in the corn than a lot of us even think.
That makes a lot of sense. You killed a buck. We were reading that story about when you climbed the irrigation pivot.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. You might elaborate on that a little bit as an example, because that was early season, if I'm correct.
It ended up being about right around the 1st of October that year, but it was, again, early in the year, and this was before Nebraska went to the September 1 opener, and it seems like September 1 opener, if you do have a bean field, it might still be green at the beginning of the season, and, you know, I would home in on that. But this property, the farmer never puts in beans. He always puts in corn, and it's a round corn field, the center pivot, half mile wide, and there's just no way to really visually scout it. You can't get up in any tree and visually watch deer enter it. It just doesn't work that way. And we've got development on both sides of this property, and there's picture a half mile round cornfield, but there's a slough running from the center of this where the irrigation pivot is. There's kind of a grassy, weedy slough that runs directly east, so basically to 3 o'clock. And again, my usual spots weren't working for me, so I thought there's got to be something going on here, and I went out and scouted out this slough in the middle, and there'd been a lot of activity, and the deer are actually rubbing. They're doing a heck of a shredding job on a lot of the big marijuana plants. And there's no trees out there, but there's, you know, some of these big giant marijuana hemp plants, and they're rubbing the heck out of them. So I thought, well, I'm going to climb the center pivot. And over a period of like 3 days, I end up seeing a number of bucks out in this, and they were stalkable, but I didn't see anything. And I did actually stalk up on a group of three or four in this wet, low spot, but they weren't bucks I wanted to shoot, but they were 110-inch or 115-inch stuff. They were pretty interesting to get that close to on the ground. And they were all acting showy, and out in the middle of a cornfield, but in a grassy spot, weedy spot, where I'm sure they never got bothered. And so on the third day, if I recall, I was up on the actual center pivot itself because of the wind situation. And about sunset, a nice buck walked out of the corn into this grassy swale. And the farmer, when he's done irrigating for the season, he will leave that pivot over this grassy slough area. So then once he starts harvest a month or so later, he doesn't have to move it. He can just get to work on the harvest. He doesn't have to worry about the pivot being in the way. Well, anyway, the pivot, then each one of the pivot legs is parked over this. But I went right to the center pivot and sat on it. And it was really slow this evening. And then the one nice buck stepped out, and he was good enough for the girls I'd go with. And so I had half hour maybe tops, and I was like, what are you going to do? And he was busy. There's a bunch of different types of stuff to browse on in this grassy strip, and it's about 30 or 40 yards wide. And like I said, it extends from the center of the field all the way to the east. And he obviously wasn't going to get to me by the end of shooting light. So I crawled down and got back into the corn rows. And I thought, if I can get down these corn rows, even where he is, come out on a pivot track, I might be able to make a stalk on him. And so I did that, but the pivot or the corn rows were angled slightly away, and it had been windy all day and it dried out the corn, and so I was making a little bit of noise. And so by the time I was getting close to the second pivot leg, which was where this buck was, you know, came out at, I knew by now he probably had heard something. And so I wasn't going to be able to be completely stealthy, so I thought, well, this is going to sound crazy, but I'm going to start trying to sound like a deer. And every now and then, those of us that hunt near corn, we'll see deer go into a field, and we'll hear them trying to shut the corn down, and they hear raccoons doing the same thing. And so I started kind of yanking on corn as I was going through there and trying not to be quiet. And as I got closer and I got to the second pivot leg, now I had to go about 20 or 30 rows back to the lane that comes in along this grassy strip. And, you know, I knew by now that if the deer is still there, I'm within 30 or 40 yards, but he can certainly hear me. And so I'm, like I said, I'm shucking, you know, yanking on these corn ears and making some random noises, trying to sound like a deer. And I even grunted a few times, and I know it was early for that, but it was October 1 or October 2 or something along those lines. And I got really, and I'm losing daylight too. And I'm in that pivot track getting closer and closer to the edge, and the corn's starting to get thin ahead of me, and I've only got maybe 10 rows, 8 rows left to go, and all of a sudden I saw one of the tassels on the corn ahead of me moving, and so I stopped, and sure enough, there was a deer, you know, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 yards from me in the corn, and he wasn't exactly on the pivot track, but he was on in a corn row right next to the pivot track, and I just froze, and he froze, and it seemed like forever, and I grunted once or twice. And finally, the deer bolted, jumped onto the corn, or into the pivot track, and then jumped back out into the open where the grassy area was. And I thought, whew, now the gig's up, but that's pretty cool. And I could tell it was a buck. I didn't know what buck it was, but it looked like a decent buck. And I thought, it's pretty cool to be able to get within, you know, within 10 yards on the ground in a cornfield doing what I was doing. So I was pretty excited about that. But then I kept listening, and I didn't hear him bound away through all that grassy, weedy stuff. And so I thought, you never know. So I kept tiptoeing up there, and I'll be darned, that buck had just jumped out of the corn and ran about 10, 15 yards and was standing there looking back at where I was. And I was able to kind of use my longbow to poke a hole in the leaves above me, and I actually had to pull the bow back once or twice to get it to create room so I could make my draw, and he can't see me. I mean, he knows something's in there, but maybe he thinks I'm still a deer. Mm-hmm. And I'll be darned, he's standing there quartering away, looking back at me, and I let him have it. And it's probably a 20-yard shot from the ground, and he barreled across the other side and went into the corn on the other side of that grassy strip, and I could hear him come to a giant thud, and I could see all the grass or the tassels on the corn moving, and that was that. And it was just a crazy ending to a neat hunt. And he's about a 130-inch buck, but taken the way I took him, it was a pretty neat thing.
That's unforgettable. I mean, that's really cool. And before Before we go on to the next subject, I want to grill you a little bit on this, on hunting standing corn like that. Are those bucks that you're seeing in standing corn, do you think they're bedding in the middle of those cornfields, or do you think in most situations they target those waterways or those grassy strips inside the corn?
I know that there's some beds. You'll see beds in that grassy stuff, but I also think they're bedding pretty heavily in the corn too. And I, you know, hesitate to even say this, but I think a guy could probably get some answers to some questions with the new drones that are out. And, you know, just to satisfy his own idea, you know, curiosity in some cases.
Right.
I don't have a drone or access to one, but boy, I think that there are a lot of deer that are spending some time in that corn in the summer. And I get a number of trail camera pictures that seem to me to be deer leaving the corn and going back to the woods at night, which is the opposite of what,
yeah,
you know, your intuition tells you is going on. And then I also, a couple different examples, but killed a really nice drop time buck from the ground. And I was actually leaving the field early that day because of the mosquitoes and I wanted to get home. I thought I was going to, you know, salvage some time with the kids instead of wasting time as a train came by. Everything was perfect. It's time to leave early. And I got down, I was walking back along the outside of the edge of the corn and ended up killing a really nice, 150 some inch drop time buck. And he was, you know, I didn't know his situation because when I came upon him, he just kind of raised up out of this brome grass and I was able, and he was kind of, you could tell he didn't know which way to go, whether to go back to the corn or go to the woods. And I was kind of in between both. And I was able to get an arrow on the string and let him have it. And that deer, when we field dressed him, I cut open his stomach and he was full of corn. And my feeling is that he had been in corn all day and was going back to the timber at, you know, half hour or 15 minutes before sun or before quitting time, which is, again, it's counterintuitive. But I do think that a lot of deer, especially if the mosquitoes are really lousy in the woods or if there's something else that, you know, maybe it's dry in the woods and they want some access to water and this field's being irrigated, I don't know. But there's something that is making some of these deer stay in the corn. And then the big deer I killed 2 years ago, he came from the corn to the woods at quitting time. And it was a freakish deal. We can talk about that deer later too. But I do think there's something to that there's a lot of deer there spending some time in the corn, perhaps as a way to get away from bugs or get away from predators or who knows.
I would think so.
Yeah. Has that become more of your hunting strategy early in the season? Because you said you don't manipulate your properties. You don't have food plots. Maybe the beans are turning. I don't know if you have oaks on the properties you hunt. So has corn kind of become more of your strategy revolve around cornfields early?
Quite a bit. And I think the other thing is early in the season, because I really only have four spots I hunt and I hunt so much, I know that it would be really, really easy to destroy the solitude and really put the deer on red alert if I'm not careful. And so early in the season, my strategy 95% of the time is to hunt the edge, and literally the edge meaning where I can get in and out as quickly and quietly as I can without making any deer think I'm any more than the farmer doing something that happens normally. And so what happens is I do spend a lot of time, you know, maybe only 200 or 300 yards from my pickup, and my pickup's parked over there along the lane right next to the development. So hopefully, you know, if they hear my pickup start, it just sounds like one of the cabins, residents starting up their rig and heading out or whatever. And so I think it's the only way I can foster this illusion that the deer aren't being hunted. And because if I go back into the timber too much, they're gonna clue in on that really quickly, I'm afraid.
That's interesting that you find them in the corn a lot. I mean, we see that also, especially with mature bucks. I just think, you know, that they're gonna go to wherever they are the safest, you know. I mean, wherever mm-hmm. they just do not encounter human scent, where they've got everything that they need. I mean, a lot of times those corn stalks are full of moisture even early in the season. I'm sure they can drink there. But if you found, like, if you find a waterway or a water source out in the middle of one of those cornfields, that it can be pretty deadly as well?
Well, I think that grassy slough I was telling you about before, if the, you know, when the center pivot spends part of its time over that, there are puddles in there for sure. And a lot of the vegetation you see would be like the vegetation you'd find along the rim of a pond or something like that. And so there's some low spots in there. And the field undulates a little bit anyway, and so I think that there probably is some water source options there. There also is a slough kind of in the grassy transition area between the woods and the cornfield. So there's other sources for water, but I would also think that this would be a pretty safe one where they don't really have to expose themselves very much. And this property also, I mean, it, like I said, you kind of got a round cornfield, and then you've got a grassy transition zone of, or you did before the logging took place, of a bunch of different types of trees, a lot of cedars and some dogwood and cottonwoods and stuff like that, and mulberries. And then there's a slough running through all this that sometimes you have to get fairly wet to cross, and sometimes they can find the low spots to cross, or even a dry spot or a lane here or there. And I hunt along those locations as well. Again, I ideally trying to find a place where I can get in, hunt, not spook anything, and then sometimes, a lot of times, if a train comes by 5 or 10 minutes before quitting time and it's loud, and it's one of those quiet nights where there's hardly any wind, I'll climb down when that train's coming by and I'll get out then. And maybe I'm deluding myself thinking that the deer aren't hearing me, that type of thing. But I would rather cut a hunt short than get stranded up in a tree and then it's too late and I can't see what's going on, and I bust out and I end up blowing a bunch of deer out of there and boogering up that spot for the future. So I'm very careful in the early season, and I do cut some hunts short because of wind situations.
This portion of the show is brought to you by Real Tree Camouflage. Right now you can go over to their website, realtree.com, check out their online store. They just released the 2017 version of Monster Bucks. I think this is the 25th year they've been doing Monster Bucks. That's just crazy. I've been watching them since I was a little kid, even back in the days when they were producing the old VHS tapes. Me and my cousin would be on our summer vacations away from school and run into town once a week, just waiting for these videos to come out so we could watch them and get amped up for deer season. But right now you can go to their online store. You can purchase the new Monster Bucks DVDs. They're chock full of action-packed hunts for giant bucks all over the country. You don't want to miss them. And they also have some great promotions going on there right now. Any orders over $25 get free shipping inside the continental U.S. So go over to the Realtree online store, check out Monster Bucks and some of the other apparel and items that they've got there to help you get ready for the season.
Earlier you mentioned a buck that you shot, I believe in 2015, it was your biggest one ever, and you said that was related to the corn, and you said we could talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, that thing is huge.
Yeah, I wish the listeners could see.
It's a giant.
That was a crazy deal. That deer was a kind of a unique looking buck, and it was in recent issue of Bowhunter magazine, and it was a really interesting buck, different looking, and like I said, I'm not... I'm not super picky about the deer I want. I want to kill a nice deer each year, and what that deer is each year varies to a lot of people. Some people might say, oh, it's not something I'd shoot. That's fine. It doesn't have to please you. It's just pleasing me. Well, this deer, the year before, was probably about 112, 113-inch coof. Kind of a unusual buck. His antlers kind of came out together with the tips nearly touched, and it was just an unusual looking deer and made him very distinct. And well, for the first day of the season that year, I about got him killed. He walked by, and again, that 112, 13-inch deer, well, when he's in full velvet, you're all excited, and I probably would have shot him that year opening day. Well, as it turned out, he walked out of range, and I got a lot of really good pictures of him with another smaller buck with him. And then, well, as the season went on, I ended up killing another deer, and then I ended up killing a second deer that would end up being a really nice buck, and about 150-incher, I think, 145-inch, 5x5. But as it turned out, I'm glad I didn't kill this deer, because he exploded from a 112, 113-inch deer to end up being 173, I think. And this buck, he went bonkers with non-typical stuff around the bases, his beams, just everything about him just blew up. And I was happy to find his antler in between. And then when I got the first trail camera video of him, probably sometime in July, I was shocked at what happened to this deer. I dropped everything and I was going to focus on this deer. And I do think I ended up killing him early in September. I ended up killing him when he came out of the corn going back to the timber. And he actually came in right over my own footprints. And he followed me in and got to right where my sweet spot is to shoot, except now he's quartering to me instead of quartering away. He came from the corner. I was literally getting down out of the tree. And when I turned back one last time to look, and there he was, stepping out of the corn. And I had to wait and wait and wait. And finally he decided he's going to go back to the corner, or at least turn around anyway, and then I let him have it. But just a tremendously interesting, cool, impressive deer. And I, you know, the tree I killed him on, I usually don't have my trail cameras right out on the same path that I'm hunting. It's usually more to get an inventory, but this one is also a good place to get inventory. He had walked by that tree one time in probably the 2 months before the season. But this tree has also been a really good tree for me. It's a tree where I can also see quite a bit of area, so I usually learn something. And it was also the very tree that he walked under the year before on opening day, going from the woods to the corn that year. So there's a lot of cool angles to this story, but I did find one of his sheds, and so I can give you a very real estimate that he was about a 112 to 113 deer, and he went to about a 173. Just crazy.
That's incredible. And what did you think he went from 3 to 4?
I'm thinking from 3 to 4, but you know, and here's another thing. Probably some of your listeners might be a little disappointed, but I haven't had any of these deer aged. I don't know. I care, but I don't care a lot. The rack he wore the year before, I would have guessed would have been either a big 2.5 or a younger or a smaller 3.5. And so, yeah, I'm guessing 3 to 4.
Sure. Yeah, it's an incredible deer. If anybody wants to see it, they can go to BryceLambley.com, and you have that deer on your webpage there. He's worth looking at.
Yeah, he's a monster, and that's intriguing. You were actually set up in, well, what I would consider an observation stand, correct? And he
right,
came by. Do you do a lot of observations like that early in the year in spots that are open,
yeah,
that you can see along with?
Yeah, a lot of my early season stands are set up for both. There's a nice trail that goes through here, and this is also kind of a unique setup, because if there's a south wind, it's good regardless. But I can actually get by with a north wind, which doesn't happen a ton in September, but you'd be surprised how much it does happen. And I can get by with the north wind here. The deer are going basically southeast to northwest if they're coming from the timber. And this tree I'm in is high for me. I usually hunt 10, 12 feet. This is a little bit higher. And I use milkweed filaments, and the wind almost always blows my scent over the close trail. And where the deer are coming, they almost never smell me, but it's one of those situations where I think deer think that they've got it all covered. They're smelling everything in front of them. And they're not smelling me because of the unique location of this tree. It's a big giant cedar. And so it's worked out really well. And like I said, it works out very well for observation as well. Because if a deer doesn't come down that specific trail, I do get to monitor a couple other places where they cross this creek, this slough. And so I can, you know, hopefully leave with a little better idea of what to do next time than I did before the hunt. And so, yeah, some of my early season stuff, especially the stuff on the edge, it's hunting / observation, absolutely.
So, ideally, for an early season hunt like this, you're observing these bucks, and then you're locating their weakness and moving in, doing whatever you have to do, whether it's hunt on the ground or climb up a little small tree in order to kill them.
Yeah, and I don't know where I've read this. It may have been Gene Wenzel. It may have been somebody else I heard. But and I subscribe to this idea of trying to find a situation where there's that perfect tree that's almost perfectly wrong. It's just, you know, again, there's a couple places on this property where the trails that are in place, I believe the deer feel like they're walking into a headwind, and they're smelling everything in front of them, and there's just one little place in there where that's not so. And those places are kind of hard to identify sometimes. On this property, they're fairly easy to identify. But a lot of other properties have a hard time with, you know, finding this type of location. But I don't think it makes, you know, I think sometimes we give human-like qualities to deer, and maybe that's wrong, maybe it's right, I don't know. But sometimes I think deer can feel very confident or arrogant or whatever you want to call it if they've got that wind in their face. And if you can find a place where that wind seems to be in their face, but because of some kind of subtle thing, like your wind's blowing over the top of them, or you know, they're coming at an angle, and you know, by the time they get to your scent, it's too late type of situation. Of course, those are dangerous too, because if it's not a deer you want and he gets into your scent stream, he's going to blow out of there and be smarter next time. But generally speaking, this particular tree, nothing wins me there, and I can have a lot of deer walk by 10 to 15 yards away on the upwind side of me, but they came from almost straight downwind. But the key there is almost straight downwind. And by the time my scent stream gets down to the ground on this particular setup, I don't think it's getting down to the ground probably for 50 or 60 yards, and that's right over the water. And the other side of that's a dike. And so it's kind of a unique situation. But I think if hunters are careful and really, really looking for that type of situation, they can maybe find that on their properties.
Yeah, that's great. Real quick, Bryce, we mentioned earlier you're a traditional bow hunter. And as I'm listening to some of these stories that you're telling and that I've read, obviously shooting traditional equipment can limit how far you can shoot, but I'm wondering, does it also give you an advantage with these snapshots where a deer maybe knows something's wrong and then turns to go away, and you're able just to get a quick shot off, whereas with a compound, maybe you don't get that shot?
There are numerous times I feel, honestly, better off with a stick bow. Now, that wasn't last year during antelope season, but there's a lot of times I feel like I'm actually better off with a stick bow. And again, if I was using a compound, I might set up differently. I might set up in a situation where I could monitor a little bit larger area, and I probably would hunt just a little bit differently. But I do think using a stick has made me more responsive, and you can shoot a stick bow much quicker. And if you do it enough, I think you can get really good at it. Now, again, I don't shoot much further than 20 yards in the field. I've killed a few deer further than that, but it's been a situation where after I walked up to the deer or walked up to my arrow in the ground and I stepped it off, like, wow, that was further than I thought it was. But I like to set up for 15 to 16, 17 yard shots. That kind of seems to be my sweet spot. And I like that distance of shot. But I do think, like you said, there have been a number of my deer, and actually going all the way back to when I went to Africa in 94 and 99, there were a couple situations there where the shot materialized very quickly. The animal was not at the right situation, not broadside, that type of thing, and all of a sudden the situation opened up and instincts just took over. So I do think there's a trade-off. Obviously I lose distance compared to the guy with the compound, but I do think there's a responsiveness that is you can't get with a compound that you can get with a longbow like I use.
Right.
These hunts where you're hunting these bucks in these tiny little trees a lot of times are interesting. I was reading that one story in your book last night, actually, about the big body buck that you killed on, I believe, the 4th of October, maybe back in the year 2000.
Yeah.
You were talking about that tree and how you needed a very specific wind only to hunt that. And that kind of goes back to the point you were just making a minute ago about hunting a just off wind for the deer. You might elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I think, you know, again, if for your listeners, there's a river on the south, big river, and then big timber just north of that, and then there's a dike on the north side of the timber, and then there's all this riparian stuff that's leading on further north to the corn. Well, the obvious place to set up early season is along that dike, but here's the problem. A south wind, and the guys that spend a lot of time out in the field have figured this out. A south wind blowing through the trees and blowing over those trees, those big cedars and cottonwoods, when it reaches that more open air on the north side of that big timber, that south wind will curl back in to the timber. And that curlback effect it's saved a lot of deer's lives, I can guarantee you.
Sure.
And what I've learned through a lot of mistakes there is I can, you know, I think, well, I'm north of them. It's a south wind. I should be okay. No, I'm not, because that wind will come over the top of those trees, find me, and then curl back into the woods. And what I've found over the years is those deer will stage just in the north edge of that timber, and they're patient. And they'll wait and wait, and they'll wait till I either move, if I'm in a tree where it's visible, or they'll wait till they smell something, and they'll either fade away or get them blow, and you realize you blew it yourself. And so what I found is that for those trees right along the dike, that the only wind that will work, because the north wind won't work, it blows you right, you're sent right in there. South wind won't work either, and usually if there's, you know, there's some south or some north in the wind, it just doesn't work. But if there's a no wind situation, then you would assume your scent would just be settling down. And there's a tiny, tiny little mulberry tree just on the north side of that dike, right alongside one of these trails that the deer like to use to leave the timber, then head off through this slough grass and riparian stuff to get to the corn. Well, anyway, if you're in that tree and there's a no wind day and you can remain deadly still and not be, you know, noticed for your movement, you can sometimes catch a deer that I watched them. I've watched them come up there. All of a sudden I've seen their antlers, and I'll stand there for 3 or 4 minutes, and then they'll take a couple more steps and I can see their eyeballs, and then I can see, you know, their neck, and they're taking their time waiting for anything to tip them off. And in this situation, it just worked out perfectly. This buck came up there, and it was a small mulberry tree. And, you know, by the time I climbed up into where I could find a nest in there and put a stand, it was almost eye level with the deer if they're standing on top of the dike. And as it turned out, that's exactly what happened. I ended up killing the deer really, really close range. And he was just a giant of a body. And if both sides would have matched his good side, he'd have been 150 some plus. He was just an incredibly, incredibly cool deer, and an even greater situation, because I ended up killing him basically at eye level at less than 10 yards.
Wow. Yeah. So what are some quick tips for getting into little bitty trees like that? I mean, you've identified that as their weak point on that wind, and you got in there, and they came by, and you got a close shot at him. But man, a lot of people will be intimidated, I think, by looking up at one of these little toothpick trees and thinking they can climb up just a few feet and kill them. But you obviously do it over and over again. What are a few tips for folks setting up in unorthodox places like that?
Well, one of them, I think I need to take this tip myself and lose some weight, because honestly, I think your own body size can be a factor in there. And another thing is, you know, I like to carry a pack with, you know, some water and reading material and everything else, is like anybody does. But in some of these small trees, you can't do that. I think anything you take up there just makes more of a something or another that the deer are going to see. And so I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is people get really trim happy when they're putting in their stands. And if you've got a situation like that, you've got to be really, really careful not to trim out too much. This same tree would work in the wintertime, I believe, but you'd have to have snow camouflage on and you would have to not move. And I think it would, you know, it's a situation that would work there as well. I think people get intimidated by small trees, thinking that you can't hunt them and that you're going to get seen. But I have found that in many cases, especially a small tree that doesn't have other trees around it, that the deer give it one look and they don't think about it again. One of the other chapters in that book talked about a buck that I ended up killing literally just right below me I'm like, maybe it was in the book or maybe it's since then, but I killed a buck basically in what basically looks like CRP ground, and there was one very young cottonwood growing up there, and I was probably, I know I could touch my tree stand with my longbow from where the deer was standing when I killed him. And I found this when I was hunting prairie grouse out in western Nebraska, up in the sand hills, that you might be, there might be one lone tree, but if you walk by that tree, you'll probably find a deer trail fairly close to it. I don't know if they're using them as landmarks or whatnot, but in this situation, there was a faint trail right alongside this tree, and that tree was no bigger around than my thigh. And it branched out into three or four branches up there. In fact, it was the craziest jerry rig that I had to do to even get the tiniest lock on to lock in there. Dick Idle used to pedal a lock on Windwalker, I think it was, and it's a tiny little stand. And it took me a long time to be able to get that stand wedged in there. But sure enough, the buck walked out and he walked right underneath that tree, and he ended up crossing, smelling right where I crawled up the tree. He never looked up that tree once. He just looked out into the cornfield that he was going to see if, I assumed to see if he could see something that raises his flagged up for him. And anyway, long story short, I was actually videotaping him because I didn't think he was as big as he was, and when he got really close underneath me, I realized he's a lot bigger than I thought, and I was able to hang the video camera up, grab my longbow, and shoot him at a distance of about 3 yards from the base of my tree. And again, I think that it's very intimidating for a lot of people to hunt from a small tree, and a ladder going up a small tree, I think the deer would notice it. I think you've got to be kind of stealthy in that regard. I don't use a lot of tree steps anymore. I like ladder sticks, but this might be a situation where a couple tree steps and a couple of the actual branches on the tree are what I use to climb up in there. I think if people limit themselves to big trees that are really bushy and so forth, they are missing out especially in some situations where there's not a lot of trees to begin with.
Did you go into that hunt thinking that that tree was going to work?
Well, the strange thing was, yeah, I did actually. And this was the first time I'd actually been on. This is my fourth best property, and it's really hard to hunt. That's why I don't have a lot of pressure from anybody else. They look at it, they'll hunt birds on it, but they don't hunt deer on it because it's just too hard to hunt. And literally when I walked out I got there early and I was going to put this tree stand up, and I knew what tree I wanted to put it in. It was the only one I could put it. That's really one of the biggest trees on the entire property. And when I walked in, I jumped this same buck up out of the grass, the CRP grass he was bedding in, and he took off toward this weedy area about 150 yards away. And I don't think he sees much farm action or anything down there. And what he does, he doesn't end up chasing him. And so it was super windy that day, and I went right back. I was actually going to scout the property that day and then maybe put a stand up toward dark. Well, I went right back to my truck, grabbed my tree stand and put it in the tree. And I'm probably putting my tree stand in, and he's probably 150 yards away from me where I think he went in. And I think he probably just laid down again. And 3 hours later, whatever it was, he walked right down that trail to the corn that I walked right under my tree, the same buck. And he was, he's a 140-inch 4x4 or 4x5, and just a neat situation. And I think most guys, I know one of the guys that's a farmhand on that property, he's a deer hunter, and he said, you can have that section. He said, I can't find a tree to hunt out of. And it is hard. It's very hard. And a week or two after that, the leaves would probably be out of the trees, and that tree would be no good anymore for me.
Yeah, that's a good tip, especially for early season hunting like that, when all that vegetation is still on. But you actually were sitting in a stand. You weren't up on a limb or anything in that case.
No, I took I had a lock on Windwalker, and it's an old stand, and I've had to do a lot of adaptations to it to make it work for me. It's tiny. It's uncomfortable. You got both feet standing there, and the platform is just about as big as both of your booted feet. It's tiny, but that was the perfect stand for that tree. And I literally had the bases against the tree, but the top part where you have to wrap your belt around, it was actually around three different branches, and I had to wrap it around different ways to get it in there, and I had to do it quietly when that deer was 150 yards away from me or less. And it was, but yeah, that was where I had planned to go. It was either that or hunt from the ground. And again, that was my other option. My other option was to get in the corn adjacent to one of these corn entrances, or these trail entrances into the corn, and hunt from there. But I felt like I had a better option from this tree.
Yeah, I think that kind of outside of the box thinking is what separates maybe your more successful hunters from other hunters. And I know that I was up on Mike Lutz's property one time, and he was showing me a tree where he shot one of his best bucks out of it. It was a similar situation, an open brome grass field. It was the only little tree where these deer were crossing to go from woods to brassica field. And yeah, I mean, you almost wouldn't think that you could get away with it, but yeah, sure enough worked. And he said the deer, two mature bucks came by the tree, and he's able to shoot one of them. And they never
my brother did. Scott and I, I'm sorry to interrupt, but my brother Scott and I used to hunt neighboring properties. He had permission on his property, I had permission on mine, but we couldn't hunt each other's, but they butted up to each other. And deer would come out basically on the fence line between the two properties and go across this giant cow pasture on their way to agricultural fields on his side of the property. And we never killed a deer from here, but we noticed, we both saw that the deer would always walk by the lone tree out in the middle of that cow pasture. There's a big, big dead old cottonwood out there, just a big old sentinel. But they would always walk within 10 yards of that. And it was just, I don't know, it just seemed weird because they had this, you know, big quarter mile by quarter mile pasture to walk through, and they always chose to walk by this tree. And so I don't know if there's a landmark situation going on there or something. But I
think so. I mean, there's
a story
some,
about Mike doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, there's some commonalities there. I talked about Dan Infault earlier. He hunts those marshes up in Wisconsin all the time, those public marshes that are just nothing but cattails. And he says the same exact thing. He said they'll landmark a tree in that marsh, and there'll be a network of trails leading out of that marsh that go right up by that tree. He said that either they're bedding under it a lot of the time because it's the only piece of dry ground out there, or they're just, like you mentioned, landmarking it and walking past it. So that's something to definitely keep in mind if you're hunting open terrain like that. You've just got one lone tree out there. The only other thing I was wondering, do you have, like, other deer coming past that tree that night, or was that the only deer?
Well, that I remember it was, there was a Nebraska's playing Missouri in football that night, and I was kind of, I was skipping the first half of the game, and it was blowing 30 miles an hour. Most guys, there's no way they'd be hunting. And the other thing was, being in a tiny tree like that, I was almost getting seasick up there.
Yeah.
And but that night, again, there's not a lot of deer on this property, but that night he was with another buck, and the right about dark, him and the other buck showed themselves. They must have stood up out of their beds and were advancing toward the corn, and he happened to come first. And I was really glad he was first. But again, he did step right onto my entry, and he stopped there, and he looked hard out in the corn and so forth. I probably could have touched his antlers with my bow. Reached down, and if I leaned over, I probably could have tapped him. That's how close he was, and he never looked up once. And so that's kind of interesting. But, yeah, that's an issue for, I think, for ground blind hunters as well. Ground blinds, I think, would be awesome in many situations, but it just seems to me like when you're hunting from the ground, if you have large quantities of deer coming around, sooner or later you're going to get nailed. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my concerns about some situations, is that if I've got to have six or seven or eight does and fawns swing by first before that buck's going to show himself, I better be really well hidden, or else one of those does is going to peg me.
Do you see that these mature bucks are off by themselves more early in the season like that than hanging around the does?
Yeah, but you know that the big buck I killed 2 years ago, he was with a couple of the does, and you know, he wasn't dogging them or anything like that, but he was with them. But a lot of these deer, it seems like they're either by themselves or with one or two other buddies, and you know, small batch for groups. And it seems to me like, you know, a lot of times my early season numbers will you know, reveal, boy, there's a lot of bucks you're seeing. Or, you know, somebody would look at it, my totals, and I'm seeing just as many bucks as I am does. And I think it's just I'm homing in on where I've been able to find bucks in the past. And if I do see one buck, a lot of times it'll be three or four.
Yeah, so you said you hunt upwards of 80 to 90 days per season. So you're almost going every day. So is there any weather conditions that you won't hunt in?
I stay home in a downpour, and it's not because I don't want to be out there in the rain. It's just I had a blood trail go bad in the rain one time, and it's just too iffy.
Yep.
And, you know, a light rain, that might be a different story, but if it's just a hard downpour or thunderstorm, your life changes when you have kids. You start making smarter decisions for your own personal health, and I don't like to be out in the woods when it's lightning out. I don't like to go out for a jog in the same conditions either. But I do like to run in the rain, and I like to hunt in a light rain. But if it's raining hard, I just don't think it gives you much for a blood trail. And the places I hunt, it ends up almost invariably that I rarely see the deer go down. Even if they go down within 30 or 40 yards, it seems like if they get back into the cedars and cottonwoods, anything can happen. They can turn any direction and so forth, and I want that blood trail. So I think if you were in more open country where you could watch the first 100 yards that the deer is running away from you, you could watch it the whole way. That'd be a different story. Then I probably would. But I also use feathers on my arrows. And, mm-hmm. you know, you can do some treatments on the feathers to make them more waterproof. But the situation that I lost the deer in the rain was partly because of a blood trail, partly because the hit wasn't very as good as it should have been. And that deer was actually killed by my hunting partner about a month later. But I remember when I looked down at my arrow, as I was just getting ready to pull back, and my feathers were all matted down. I thought he was close enough it wouldn't matter, but it turned out it did.
Kind of along the same lines of hunting 80 to 90 days per year, I know one of the things I've always enjoyed is seeing the pictures of you, and we've been talking mostly about early season hunting, but you always seem to get out late in the season, oftentimes in a snowstorm, hunting to the very end of the Nebraska season. What drives you to go into the woods and stay out there all season long after 70, 80, 90 days?
That's a good question. And I think it would probably be the nagging doubt that, you know, maybe he would have walked by in late December and I gave up too early.
Yeah.
That's probably part of it. But I think it's more than that. I think bow hunters have limited themselves, you know, with their choice of weapon. And I've probably limited myself a little bit more with a longbow in terms of distance and things like that. And so it's got to be more than just a kill. Cause if it was just about the kill, there's some other things I would do differently. But it's, I don't know. I think there is something special about, you know, you start a season in sweltering heat and green everywhere, and you're picking ticks off you and got your thermocell and everything else going on. And then you end up and it's the polar opposite, literally. There's something really cool about that. I don't know. I like Nebraska. It's got seasons, and I think you know. And you can even maybe make a reference back to high school sports, and you have your different seasons, and you shift gears and between mm-hmm. you know, football and cross country, and then it's basketball wrestling season, then it's track season, and I don't know. There's something about that makes sense to me, and it's something I don't want to miss anything. I wanted to be out for three sports in high school and be successful. I want to be out there. And, you know, there's a side of me, too, that I want to hunt waterfowl and upland and stuff like this. But I think when you get to be a serious bow hunter, it's hard to do those other things. Maybe those other things happen when you have an especially fortunate year and you tag out early and you're able to do some of those other things that you grew up on. I'm not sure young people today do go through all that, you know, shooting a squirrel and rabbit first and then, you know, maybe shooting a pheasant or a quail or something like that. And you know, I don't think everybody goes through those stages the same order that they did back when I was a kid. But I do think there's something special about seeing a season through from beginning to end. And you know, killing a deer on the opening day and killing a deer on the last day, sometimes it just seems appropriate. That's actually happened once or twice for me. And it's just, I don't know, it seems something appropriate. And I should clarify that, you know, when I say I hunt 80 or 90 times a year, I count a morning hunt and an evening hunt separately. But even then, if I'm hunting, if I get in 90 hunts, you know, there's, you know, double weekend. I usually hunt 3 or 4 times on a weekend, but I still rarely skip a day or two during the season if I can help it. And then I did spend 3 years coaching cross country here recently because the former coach quit, and there wasn't an heir apparent at the time. And as the distance coach in track that for the team, and I was the heir apparent if anybody was going to take it over, and I didn't want the program to fall apart or anything like that. So I did it for 3 years, and boy, was that a tough, you know, serving two masters, coaching sure. cross country and wanting to be out hunting. But it, as it turned out, I was able to kill that big 170 some inch deer that same year that I was coaching cross country. So it does, you know, require a lot of effort, but I like seeing the seasons go through, and I like testing myself against all those different seasons.
Yeah, that's great. And that's that time in the field is why you're a valuable source of information. And
yeah,
I think there's a lot more we could discuss with you, but probably yeah. better get back to the family and get your daughter's nails done.
Yeah, there you go.
yeah, I'm sure that's the next thing. As soon as she hears me stop talking, she'll be bugging me about that again. But no, I'm glad to talk about that. I love the sport. I love the people you meet that are serious about it as well. It's one of the I try to share my joy of the hunt and pursuit of the whitetail, you know, with my writing. It's one way to share that passion. But I don't know, you know, it's what we're 3 months away or whatever, but it's coming quick.
Yes, it is.
Oh yeah, we were just out scouting public land this morning. We're already starting to get in gear for the upcoming season. But appreciate you coming on with us, Bryce. We'll definitely have to do this again. I've got about 50 more questions on here that I'd like to ask you. But
seriously, anytime, I'd be very very happy to do that. Yeah, that'd been a joy for me.
That'd be great if we could make you a more regular guest. And then also, speaking of your books, if people want to pick one up, they can find it at brycelamley.com. Is that correct?
It is, and I've got less than 50 copies of the first book, My Neck of the Woods, and the second book, Platte River Driftwood, I've got plenty of those, but the first one I'm just about out of, and I'm closing in on finishing the third one, but maybe this summer I can get that done now that I don't have to worry about teaching in the fall.
Sure.
Well, I'll be waiting for it.
All right. Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. I really do.
Yeah, thank you, Bryce.
Thanks, Bryce. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Well, that was a pretty interesting podcast, especially for the time of year a lot of us are thinking about early season whitetail hunting already, you know, with June coming along here, and there's nobody that knows it better than that guy right there, Bryce Lambley. And you said he's from Blair, right?
Where you grew up? Yeah, born in Blair and has lived in Fremont, I believe, all his life. So, right in my neck of the woods, but yeah, that was a great podcast and really gives you something to think about as far as hunting strategies early season, deer being in the corn, hunting from small trees. Yeah, I mean, it's already got my wheels turning. And
oh, yeah. I'm thinking the whole time he's talking about that stuff. And what I like about Bryce there is you can tell he's doing this for the right reasons. You know, he's a legit bow hunter, teacher, like you said, just retired from teaching. And he's doing it for all the right reasons. He doesn't really care much about score. He shows a lot of respect to all the animals that he kills. And yeah, we'll have to definitely have him on again in the future. But that's going to wrap it up for this week's episode of the Whitetail Watch podcast presented by Realtree. I appreciate you joining us, and we'll see you next time.